So thank you very much for inviting me here and making me realize how terrible mistake we made pointing beam north from Fermilab and not southwest. That was quite unfortunate. I have a bad news for you to start. I will not have any new results from Minos to tell you. We try, but we failed. My main message will be that it's very difficult and takes very long time to do neutrino experiments. And therefore, it's very important when by the time you actually do it, you do the best you can. So what I thought the best I could do is to tell you roughly what we are doing and seek your advice or help in optimizing our program. So I think I'll very quickly run through how this thing came into being at Fermilab and where we are now in our thinking about what the future steps would be. So the whole thing started sometime in the mid-80s with something called atmospheric neutrino anomaly. And at the beginning of the 90s, there was a question. Is there an anomaly in neutrino physics? And if it is, what is the origin? And there was a hint that perhaps neutrinos oscillate with some delta m squared like 2 × 10⁻². Well, if this was the case, then the obvious solution would be to build a neutrino beam to control things. And right this time would be about 700 kilometers. A 10 to 20 GeV beam energy would be just fine. So we decided to do that. So we decided to set up an experiment to test decisively what this thing is all about. So we designed a beam of neutrinos, starting from Fermilab, pointing to a student mine in Minnesota. And we said, if you want to make sure that neutrinos disappear, you want to have two detectors which are identical, and you compare what is happening here and here. If there's any difference between interactions here and here, neutrinos do oscillate. So that was quite an obvious choice, and but now once you have this kind of drawing, to put this in practice, this is actually a very long and very painful process and involves a lot of things like digging constructions out in ground. This again is a very nice drawing, but you have to realize this is about a kilometer of a tunnel, about 6 meters wide, deep underground. This is the very first construction underground at Fermilab. And we didn't have the faintest idea what it really means to dig things underground, and we learned a lot in doing that. Now, how do you make a neutrino beam? You make it very simple. You just take your protons, you take a target, then you collect all the pions of a given sign with some magnetic horns, and you have a decay volume, and you absorb muons, and what's left is neutrinos. Again, it's a very simple drawing, but this actually involves a lot of construction, a lot of work, to give you some feel. This is this little rectangle here. In reality, looks something like this. This is a gigantic tunnel, and this is a decay pipe being lowered down and installed here. And now the whole thing is here filled with concrete, because one of the major concerns is that when pions decay, they hit they can hit walls, interact, and contaminate groundwaters. So there's a lot of construction which had to go in before this little drawing can be actually realized. Focusing neutrinos is again very simple. You have a horn which does it. This is actually a very complex machinery which you can't really see inside. This is the first horn being tested with pulsing every few seconds with 200 kiloamps current. Second horn is being welded, so you again can appreciate a little bit complexity. This is the inner conductor. There'll be a cylinder to return current. And this is the thing which focuses pions into the decay volume. Now, first bombshell came up with Super K, saying that, well, actually, this delta M squared is maybe not as big as 10⁻², it's somewhat smaller. Well, by the time everything is approved, we are digging tunnels, that's a big problem to do. Luckily, we have realized that it is not that bad, because we can do something by changing the distance from the target to a horn and horns themselves. You can actually produce, using the same machinery otherwise, beams with variable energy. So we have built three beams with this original beam here covering this region about 10 to 20 GeV. By moving horn closer and moving target in, you can have a medium energy beam around 5 GeV. If you move target all the way through and bring horn second even closer, You can have low energy beam, summer, and then 3GeV. We are lucky. CERN, for example, did not do it this way, so CERN is stuck with beam like this. So, this can be done as well. But you have to do it before you start running. If you start running, once this thing is very radioactive, it's getting very, very hard. So this is, again, pointing out that it's very, very important to build in all things which you need well before you start, because otherwise things can get very difficult.
It's coming low energy beam, has lots of high energy.
Yes. Well, the problem is that these horns are focusing pylons which fall into it, but they have an opening here. And pylons going through the opening of the horn, they don't care. So this part here is always there for every beam. Moreover, which is not obvious here, this part here are pylons going through the opening horn, so both piplacises and pylanises. So this thing is pure neutrino beam. There's a mix of neutrino and antineutrino. Well, that's... So, given this, and having these two detectors, we will be able to predict of what the neutrino spectrum we should see in a far detector. And once we start running, well, maybe 2 years from now, we'll measure what the spectrum will be. So this is what we expect on the basis of near detector, and we measure something. Ratio of this to that will be giving us directly survival probability of new news as a function of energy. And perhaps it may look something like that. If it does look like that, then this spectrum contains two informations. There's a dip somewhere, and the dip position is direct measurement of the delta M square involved, and the dip depth measures the mixing angle. So if we are lucky, then sometimes 3-4 years from now, we will be able to reduce this allowed area from super K and K to K into something smaller, which can be, well, somewhere. We will measure delta M squared to about 10%. If we will or will not make any progress in understanding the mixing angle depends very much on delta M squared is. If it's somewhere here, we can improve by factor 1.5 error on the mixing angle. If it's lower, then we have done very much improve our knowledge.
Is this all high energy beam?
This is low energy beam.
What?
This is low energy beam.
So this is a low energy. This is using the low energy.
Right. Okay. And actually, this thing does not really depend very much on well, with high energy beam, we'll be seeing something here. If the delta is higher, we go to medium energy beam to cover errors better. But the errors are not very, very different from beam to beam.
So is the plan to use the low energy beam first of all?
We plan to start with low energy beam. But luckily, the change is quite fast. It's a matter of a week or so to move things. We've built, it was quite a major engineering effort to build the beam in such a way they can move this very highly radioactive components. So we paid for it. But I think it was probably a wise investment.
Is the flux realistic that you have here according to what's happening now?
No. If I would show this to our director, he would hit me in the head. The current official number is 2.5 here. But again, it doesn't really matter very much. You see very clearly that we were unlucky in delta M squared being so small. We are awful lucky in missing being very, very large. Because then somewhere everything disappears. So when we are building the beam, we were thinking about things, some little wiggle somewhere. So we built a lot of bells and whistles to understand the flux. So if you have few percent effect here, you know its oscillations. But now this is the whole disappearance. This becoming very, very simple experiment, and your errors don't depend very much. Once you can cover this thing here, then you are lucky. If the telescope become very, very small, I think 1 is 10 to 3, then the thing will be going like that. And then you are on a slope. And then your understanding of the spectrum becomes a lot more important.
Can you change the beam from your beam to your?
Yes. Yes, by changing the direction of the current, you're focusing one sign, defocus the other. So by Again, it has to be built in. You have to build power supplies in such a way that you can do it. You have to change the leads, and this does it. For example, mini boom people have the same problem, but they bought power supplies which cannot be swapped. So you have to buy another set of power supplies to do that. In principle, it's very simple. Change the direction of the current, and that's it. In practice, this is always a lot more cumbersome.
Those results are for how long?
This is for 2 years run.
2 years running?
With low energy beam.
With the low energy beam?
With the four tenants.
So assuming that the main injector is delivering what?
4 times 20.
What?
4 times 20 per year. So there is quite some optimism here. But you can see that if you make these errors even twice as large, well, it won't change very dramatically. So what is happening, we actually have built almost 3/4 of the fire detector. It's taking data. We have near detector assembled in the building, ready to go. The underground construction, tunnel, caverns, is all finished. And we are now building, surface building, and outfitting the underground areas. Will take about a year. And then it will take about a year to install all these horns, targets, shielding. And we expect the first beam sometimes in the fall of 04. Or again, Mont would say January of 05. But somewhere in 2 years from now, we ought to be in running mode.
Will the cosmic data be useful?
Oh, well. Cosmic will be very useful to debug the detector, to tune all the construction, to do everything. Compared to Super K, it will be very, very tiny admixture. So, yes, we will have science selection. Therefore, one can think about telling news from new bars. This is actually very hard because the muons outweigh neutrinos. So we just put a shield around the detector to help this. So yes, we will be able in due time to say something about possible CPT violation, but that's not very and then so on, like 4 or 5 years.
What is the minimum energy that you are selecting with the possible avoidable events?
For the beam?
The
question is what the minimum energy is of such events. You can tell this charge current and tell the sign. This probably depends on the angle, because the detector has planes, so if you're going down, you may need much higher energy to see a sign of a muon. Thing going from the side, you may take lower. I would venture like 1.5 GeV. Because the cost elastic, you should be able to tell that. Well, while we are doing this, physics has changed underneath. So by now, we have different questions. We know neutrinos oscillate. We know that they're not using anything. We know that mu tau. So that today, the questions are quite different. Questions are, what is the neutrino mass hierarchy? Is it this or that? The question is, how much of new ease is in the third state here or here? This is known otherwise as the theta 1-3, or this little thing in otherwise big mixing matrix. And is there a complex phase here which may lead to CP violation in the neutrino physics? So, well, it takes 10 years to build an experiment. You build it and then say, well, this is not so longer so much interesting. So the question is, can minos do anything about these questions? Well, it is quite actually fascinating that all these questions can be answered by studying one simple reaction. New mu to new e oscillation experiment actually gives you information about all these three fundamental questions. And I am not going to tell you all this because you know much better. But things are complicated because this amplitude, or actually probability, depends on a number of things. Depends on the mass hierarchy, on distance, on energy, on mixing angles, 1-3 in particular, and as well on other mixing angles. So it is very difficult to understand how, out of measuring one number, or perhaps two numbers for neutrino and anti-neutrino, you can learn all the things which is underneath.
Could you, I'm sorry, not all of us are
oh, you're not.
Total experts. Could you say what P1, P2,
okay, P2, thank P2, you. I thought we just an insult to you people to show that. Okay. So thank you very much for this question. So we have neutrino beam, which is almost pure new mu beam. We go out there and we look, are there any new E's in this beam? And the ratio of new E's to new mu's give you probability of oscillation. And you can do these things for neutrino beam or anti-neutrino beam. And this probability will depend on a lot of things, in particular mixing angles and the CP phase and other things. But this is very, very hard to actually visualize. One more thing that is I want to mention, but maybe again not everybody knows, that we are quite lucky that neutrinos, in our case, go through the Earth. So there's some asymmetric measures of Earth. And when they do that, their mass is changing because they move in the effective potentials, Link has taught us a long time ago. And all neutrinos undergo interactions. So they have same interactions, so they undergo the same shift. But new E's have extra diagrams, new E's and new E bars, which differentiate them from others. So as a result, the mass shift of new E's and new E bars is different. So for new E component, this thing here is now moving up or down. Therefore, the delta M square, or the probability, is changing. And by seeing this thing, we can actually tell the sign of the mass hierarchy. That's too much. What one can study this in this formula and try to understand them, but it's very hard. And we have, fortunately, two people, Minakata and Onokawa, who came up with very nice, very pictorial way of combining all the physical information into this. So what they say is, if you were to measure probability of neutrinos going into new E's, and at the same time, anti-neutrino new mu's going to new E bars, then you measure two numbers, which give you a point somewhere on this plane. Now, if you had a perfect world with CP conservation and in vacuum, you'll be sitting somewhere here, somewhere on this diagonal, and the distance of the point that you measure from the origin is direct measurement of the mixing angle theta 1-3. Now, if you were in a vacuum, but CP is violated, then this point here will be actually blown into some kind of an ellipse, and the phase of this ellipse tells you the phase of a CP violation angle delta. Now, in matter, this ellipse moves, and depending on what the hierarchy is, it moves either down or move up. So, in principle, if you measure things very precisely, if you measure this point here, you know everything. You know that this is a normal hierarchy, and you know the delta is something like pi plus plus something. And you measure, you know, the mixing angle. So this is a very convenient way of trying to understand of how you can interpret these two measurements in terms of physics parameters. And it's clear that you must measure things with enough accuracy to be able to distinguish various scenarios. Now, the big question is how large this mixing angle is. And it's very important that we sort of get some feedback from new people to tell us where to shoot. Now, I took a latest paper of Altarelli, who tried to summarize of what we know, and he has classified all possible theories, all textures, and he points out that there seem to be basically two options, that this angle is either driven by electron mass over muon mass ratio, or delta M squared solar over delta atmospheric. Now, unfortunately, there are some powers involved, square roots or one-third or squares. And depending on this ratio here can be very, very different. Luckily, it looks like there are some kind of two possibilities. Either the thing is somewhere in the range of few percent, which will be very, very good for us, or it's very, very small. Now, if it's in few percent, then we as I already showed you, we actually be able to measure this. If it's very, very small, this will tell us what should be the next step in order to settle this issue. Now, the question which I have in my mind is, are there any such factors of 1 over pi or 1 over pi square in these predictions? Because that would, for us, make a big difference. For you, maybe not. So, can we do anything about it in Minos? Actually, yes. Answer is yes. Minos was designed to look for muons, so it has a sampling which is pretty coarse, but it's not that bad. It is actually about 1.5 addition length sampling. It's not ideal, but it is workable. And if you take, let's say, 3 GeV visible energy, and if this is a new E charge current, then you have an event like here, where most of the energy is in very, very few counters aligned with the beamline. This is an electron. Whereas the same kind of energy of neutral currents is energy much more spread out throughout the detector. So by taking this kind of a topological information, one can somehow distinguish at some level new E's from the background. And here's the possibility what we can do for 10 kiloton year exposure, which means 2 years of the nominal intensity or 15 years of the realistic one, if the mixing angle is 0.01, then we would expect about 8.5 events background, I'm sorry, signal with some 40 events background. That gives you a limit, some factor of 3 better than Shaw. So we'll be able to say at 90% consider that UEC squared is less than 0.01. It's not perfect, but that's something which will come as a.
I'm confused. I mean, the thing, you know, there's so much. This signal, you say 8.5 eV
Events.
For
0.01 UEC squared.
So you really need to believe you understand the background very well.
Very much so, yes.
Very much so.
Well, that's the best we can do. Well, perhaps we can do something better, but it's tough. We are clearly limited by background. And the systematic error on the background will be a dominant. We didn't build experiment to do that. So it's still remarkable that we are able to do something.
I mean, it's because it's not a good new E detector, really.
Right. It wasn't designed to be.
I understand.
How do your capabilities here compare to JHF?
Very poor. Forget it.
Yeah.
So, we want to do better experiment. Now, how you do that? There are several things. First of all, you need more neutrinos in the signal region, and you let have less background, and you want to have better detector and bigger detector. And luckily, we can do all these things. Again, it's another stroke of luck. And here, we are actually quite helped by the fact that delta N squared went so small, because at the distance to Sudan, this delta M squared tells you that the maximum probability for oscillations occurs somewhere around 1.5, around 2 GeV. So one would like to have a monochromatic beam of 2 GeV energy. Now, this is another advantage that at 2 GeV, you are below tau threshold. If you are above tau threshold, then you know that all new mu's go to new taus, taus become to electrons, and this becomes a serious problem. So there are a number of things which actually point out that having 2 GeV beam at this distance would be an ideal beam to study new mu to new E appearance. Well, and two-body kinematics helps us very much in that. If you take spinless particle and see how it decays, it boosted this particle with an ellipse of longitudinal and transverse momentum. Scales are different. Here's in GeV, here's 20 MeV. So normally, when one builds neutrino beam, one points the beam towards the detector, and we pick up neutrinos emitted at 0 degrees. And these neutrinos are proportional to the pion energy. These are different pion energy, 6, 9, to 18 GeV. So when you point, when you see the Minos, given as pion, let's say 12 GeV, we have neutrinos of 4.5 GeV, 18 GeV, 6 GeV. But notice that these ellipses all sort of come together somewhere here. And this is somewhere around 2 GeV. That means if you were to sit at some angle, which would correspond to 10 kilometers sideways from Minos, then all different pions energy collaborate to give you neutrinos of the same energy. So if you sit here, you actually have very narrow beam, and very intense beam of well-defined energy. And this energy is exactly what is called for by the current values of atmospheric delta M squared. So this is a stroke of luck. We didn't plan on this, but it happened like this. This trick has been actually discovered by people at Brookhaven. They proposed experiment a long time ago. They pointed out that if you plot at a given angle from the beam line, the neutrino energy, it becomes quite a monochromatic. Actually, funny enough, you can see here that if you see that a 15-degree angle, then as a function of pion energy, neutrino energy goes up, it is plateau, and then goes down. And from this ellipse, it's quite obvious. One has to keep in mind that in addition to kinematics, there's another part which has to do with the solid angle subtended by the detector. And the flux drops quite rapidly as a function of angle if you have high energy pions. If you take 20 GeV pions at 15 milliradians, you have 2 GeV neutrinos, but it'll be very, very tiny fraction of them. If you have low energy pions, the fraction becomes much bigger. So, if we were to run a medium energy beam into Minos, Minos would see this energy spectrum. If at the same time you had three other detectors at say 5, 10, 20 kilometer distance, and these detectors would see different beams, 3 GeV, 2 GeV, or 1 GeV. So by going sideways by some distance which you can calculate, you can choose which beam you want to be in. And in addition, at this position, this background here, this tail is very, very small. This tail, well, there's actually a peak. There's always this peak here from chaos. So this is sort of cut out here. This distance here is kinematically forbidden if you had only decays in the decay pipe. So these neutrinos are coming from decays in the target cave before pions get sent into the decay pipe. So that's why it's so small, because the decay pipe...
The ones from new decay are small?
Yes, from new decays are even smaller.
And so now what's the primary beam in this case? What energy?
120.
Still 120?
120, yes. And these beams are there, like it or not. We cannot stop them. So when Minos is taking data, there are beams all over the place. Anybody can go and put an experiment and you have it. You don't need any extra tuning or something. So, now if one had, for example, these three extra detectors, and you would compare the observed rate, this blue one, with the expected rate, you actually would see that you go away from the beam, your number of new mu's goes down, becomes very small, and then comes back. You see the oscillations going down and up. In particular, at some place you are in the minimum, and here a number of events, which you see, are directly proportional to a deviation of the missing angle from unity. So if you think that there's a new symmetry which tells you that this is one, then this is a very, very good place to test this, and you can get very good accuracy on theta angle 2, 3 at this place.
Now, what energy, I mean, do you measure the energy this thing? I mean, good.
Okay, that's not it.
This sounds like it's for monochromatic.
Right.
It's semi-monochromatic.
It's put in narrow band, and you know the energy from geography. So, actually, if you want to do very precise...
How do you, in this kind of thing, you're calculating what the beam is from what you know about the pipe.
Right.
But it's not monochromatic, it's still...
Well, it has... This width is very tiny compared with the width of oscillations. Oscillation width is going like that. So this is cutting out a very, very tiny part of a minimum. That's what helps you to make the measurement.
So you're still stuck with the uncertainty delta M squared.
Somewhat, yes. But if you had this measurement, this actually constrains your delta M squared too. So now one other thing which I wanted to point out, that if one day you would like to measure delta M squared very precisely, to percent or so. You get to know where the minimum occurs in this ratio. Now, in this plot which I shown before, let me see, I can recover that. Measuring of the length is very simple to see where the minimum is. But the thing which I have to stress that what is plotted here is the scale is the visible neutrino energy of events. This is the sum of mu momentum and hadron energy. Now, when you go to high energies, this is a very good method, and we know it works. If you come here, then actually the total visible energy in a perfect detector will be quite different from real neutrino energy, because there are effects like absorption in nucleus, for example.
And those error bars, how do we pick those error bars longitudinally?
This is a bean size. This is not optimal. I don't want to defend this. It's a mindless plot. It's showing you that you have big effect somewhere. Would you be in this way? Probably not. But doesn't make any difference.
This is not energy resolution.
No. But the energy resolution which you mentioned is probably like, from here to here. But it's very, very much better than the structure you're going to measure. Yeah, you're measuring the thing which is very, very wide. This is the answer to your question. The beam is now covering very, very small part of this curve. So the beam shape is not all that important, but in addition, it is actually okay. So let's go to neutrino appearance experiment. We would like to measure appearing new E's. Now, how you do that? You define some cuts, which say, well, this looks like an electromagnetic energy, and you count these events. So this is a new E candidate. And then you subtract the backgrounds. There are two kinds of backgrounds which are there. One is there's new E component of the beam, about 0.5%. You have to subtract this times the efficiency for finding them. And there will be some neutral current-induced events, which will look like new E events. You have to subtract them. You divide by what you expect with the spectrum, and this gives you probability. If you want to get your limits and say, well, you have to find out how big the fluctuation of the background you can admit to accommodate your events. So systematics of this measurement, we have few parts. You have to know what the flux you expect. You have to know the beam contamination. You have to know the background from neutral currents, and you have to know the electron ID efficiency. Now, luckily, all these things are not that hard. I won't go into this very much unless people want. The point I want to make is that actually we can know the expected neutrino spectrum very, very well by measuring events in near detector. We do have near detector, which measures neutrinos coming from here. Now, all neutrinos come from decays of pions. And every pion decaying here, depending on the angle, can give neutrino here or there or anywhere else. So once you know the spectrum here, you can sort of convolute the spectrum with the transfer matrix, which depends only on the decay kinematics. And this spectrum here determines spectrum anywhere else with very, very high degree of accuracy. And here is the, because one can ask the question, for any given decay pion, there's no ambiguity, you know what it is. But if you don't know the pion production spectra, then the angles may change, momenta may change, and your prediction will be quite different. And the answer is yes, it will be very different. But if you take four different pion production models, which are quite different, like 30%, and if you now try to see how much this will this transfer error from the near far detector, there are four histograms here which show the predictions of the far spectrum at different locations for very, very different pion production models.
These are muon neutrinos.
And they are very, very, very small. So the answer is we will know the muon neutrino flux expected at any location with very high accuracy. So this is not any contribution to error for new appearance experiment. However, we'll have new EBA grant, which is like 100%. How well you know that? Well, luckily, new EBA grant comes from two sources. When protons strike a target, makes you pions, which give you new mu's, that's nice, and makes you kaons. And kaons to K3 decay give you new E's. And that's a contribution. And if you want to know that, you have to know the ratio of K to pi production cross sections, which is not all that well constrained. So this is quite a big source of the systematic error. Moreover, when pions decay or kaons decay, give you muon, a muon decay and give you an electron and new E's. So here is the, as a function of neutrino energy, for different locations, 0, 5, 10, and 20 meters away from the axis, the spectrum of new mu's, or the new E's coming from kaon decay, I'm sorry, from all of them and coming from kaon decay. The shaded part is from kaons. And you notice that in the energy of interest, like 2 GeV, all of the new E's, like 90% of them, come from a muon decay. So the K to pi production cross sections does not really enter very much in your estimate of the new E background at the off axis location. That is very good, new, because these new E's here are due to pion decays, which gave you new mu's in the near protector. So this thing is constrained right away by your new mu spectrum at the near protector. Moreover, when muon decayed, gave you mu plus gave you E plus and mu E and mu bar, right? And these mu bars go forward and you measure them in near protector. So there's another bullet here is missing, that mu bar spectrum observed near detector is measuring exactly this component. So you have very, very good constraints on the thing here. So it is quite obvious that for until very, very long exposures, this thing here is dominated by purely static fluctuations of new electrons. It's not a systematic problem. That's nice. New E background, neutral current background comes from neutral currents, and this is the spectrum of neutral currents. This is a visible spectrum of neutral current events. And this is new E spectrum, and we expect signal somewhere here. So it's very obvious that we have to have decent energy resolution to cut out the window here to preserve all these events, but to minimize the number of neutral currents. I'll have to make it even more later. So the summary is that we do have new E component, which is constrained by measuring things in the new detector. This should be new bar here. And in addition, there is a coming experiment, MIP, which will measure production spectra. So we have very, very much constrained set of information constraining this thing here. We have neutral current events, which depend on the physics of neutrinos at few GeV energies, which is very well known. But we get some data from K to K, but we will have a near detector which will be measuring the occurrence of these EM objects in the same kind of the detector. And the cosmic stuff, which is expected to be very small, but we actually will measure the things very shortly in the dedicated experiment from lab. Now, one thing which I wanted to remind you that what we can do experimentally, honestly, is to say we can measure probability. We can see, we can detect new E down to 1%, 0.5%, something. And this is not unambiguously related to these fundamental parameters which we like to know, like mixing angle or CP phase. And translation from mixing angle to probability has a very, very large error coming from physics. Here's an example. Suppose one does experiment and you measure 1% probability of new mu to new appearance. And you have a fantastic good exposure, measure very well, so you know this line. Now, this line can translate into quite a number of different physics scenarios for all these ellipses from here to there. So here's an example. As a function of observed rate, measured with infinite accuracy, what is the lowest and highest angle, here 1.3, which can be allowed by this rate? So you measure 1%, you have some factor of 3 or so, factor of 3 of possible angles, theta 1.3, which can be responsible for that. So it's quite obvious there's no point. Once you see an appearance here, there's no point to run any longer this configuration because you learn nothing more. You need other measurements to learn physics. In particular, measuring antineutrinos is one of very, very important ways of making further progress. So new bars are very important because they are this key element to give you mass hierarchy and other good things. Now, it is kind of an intuition, and I was guilty of this one too, but they are very expensive in terms of protons. They have much fewer neutrino events. And this came because at high energy beams, we are talking about higher X production, there are a lot more pi pluses than pi minuses, and the cross section bites you. Now, when you go to low energy beams, we are collecting pions at very, very low values of X. There's still some advantage of having pi pluses, but very small, because charge conservation tells you that you get to use pions in pairs. You cannot put only pi pluses. So this is one thing. Second, we are very lucky again that we are, here's a ratio of antineutrino to neutrino cross section as a function of energy. And instead of 1/2 and comes down gradually, and somewhere around 1 GeV, it takes a dip. We are still sitting here where the ratio is like 0.4. If you go to much lower energies below 1 GeV, we are taking quite a penalty in antineutrinos. So in practice, when we switch to antineutrinos, we get some factor of 3 fewer events. But only 3, not 6 as it used to be at high energies. So all what we need, we have a beam which is actually quite nice and perfectly optimized for the physics and at hands. We just need more detectors. There's no way to dig another mine, so it has to live on the surface or have very small overburden. But it helps you to have very small duty cycle, so you know when a beam is coming, gives you a factor of 100,000 in the rejection. You know the direction, and you have quite high energy. So we don't think that that's a very major problem. And you need data which is big, has large mass, and has good sampling to be able to identify electrons. So if you build some kind of a low Z calorimeter, this what we see as events. This is an example of the new E charge current event, and electron track can be seen as a collection of particles which go along. This is an EM shower which start develop. Whereas all other charged particles be seen as kind of a smooth tracks with very few hot hits around it. So here's an example of a charged pion, which now may have sometimes delta ray, but otherwise you have very, very smooth line. So there is not a very deep problem in building a detector which can identify electrons. And there are different possibilities which are being right now studied. And we sort of agreed to have a goal of about 50 kiloton detector. We used to have 20, but we said, well, let's go for it. And this is designed to be in a position to see a 3 sigma appearance effect if the mixing angle is factor 10 below Shor limit. But there's no really hard way of doing this thing, so any feedback that you people can tell us what the right goal would be very, very useful to setting up this initial scale. And we can think about a low Z calorimeter with some RPCs or diff tube oscillator, or perhaps some bigger version of Icarus. Here is what I wanted to show you. How does the off-axis beam help you very much in making experiment easier by being down the background. So this is pretty busy plot. I want to go through all of it. But here is what we are stuck on axis, or Minor's case, here is off axis. And the point is that on axis, this is the spectrum of neutrinos which you have produced. And in red are those which have oscillated. So your signal, mu is, are coming from these neutrinos. But all these neutrinos give you no signal, but neutral currents from them give you background. So here is the spectrum of observed events from 0 to 20 GeV. These are appearing mu is. So if you have W1 mu c square, then from this spectrum here you have this spectrum of mu is appearing. This is the mu e component of the beam, irreducible. And this yellow thing here, I'm sorry, this green thing here, is a spectrum of neutral currents. Neutral currents coming from this neutrinos, well, you can't avoid that. But neutral currents coming from all these neutrinos here are piling on top here. So your ratio of this to this is very high. Whereas, if you go to off-axis position, then your neutrino spectrum is well matched to oscillations, and all this yellow stuff disappears. So the neutral current is still higher than your mu is in the background, but the ratio is very much smaller. So if you go to off-axis position, your ability to reject neutral currents doesn't need to be as good as here. If you want to be here, you need fantastic rejection power against neutral currents. If you are here, your requirements are a lot less stringent. Now, we are quite lucky that this beam is pointing to Sudan, but there's quite an area around here. And this beam being flat, you can pick up your position pretty much at will on a map. Well, not all positions are equally useful for experiments, but we paid a visit along these lines, and we found there are a number of places which where you can actually build experiments. And we would like to optimize our experiment from physics point of view. And that's again a plea to you people, that we have to find out physics arguments which can help us to differentiate, to tell us at which position we can make the best measurement by ourselves, and at the same time, what is the best place to have a complementarity with JHF.
But this thing goes through Lake Superior, right?
Yes.
So you actually can build a detector on Lake Superior if you wanted to.
Yes, it's possible.
What are the distances now? Your disadvantage is close to compute.
You can go from something like 700 kilometers to about 1,000 kilometers. 950 is the location which is. So here's an example. In Canada, there are two possible places, one near Kenora. This is about 950 kilometers. This is about 900 kilometers. That is the roads, which are very important.
Now, let's see. This isn't going to be a beam headed by the ground.
Same beam.
Above. Wow. This beam leaves the surface and goes up. So if you are here, neutrinos are 15 kilometers above you.
But
you are off axis. You are at the right angle here. So you can, if you put anywhere here, you have 2 GeV beam hitting your detector over this distance.
2 GeV beam has it's traveled. I mean, it's not going deep down like the...
No, it's here it's going up.
What?
So here
it's
going...
It's emerging.
It's emerged. It's emerged.
And so the beam goes through the earth.
Right.
But it's a different tunnel than it's today.
There's no tunnel.
It's just off axis. But it's off axis, so it shoots in directions over up at that point.
Right. It's just leaving Earth at that point, whereas the other beam left the Earth.
Right. And the main beam is above.
The
but
other beam went way up above. But the other beam, the beam is going above the Earth. This. And the off axis beam is just emerging from the Earth at this point.
The off axis beam is emerging from the Earth, and the other beam
is above.
Is above.
It's already going to the sky.
But that other beam emerges where?
At Sudan.
700 kilometers.
What?
At Sudan.
Is the spray from...
The other beam emerges, it goes to Sudan, and this one... Okay.
Right.
It's the same beam, just the off-axis.
It's the same beam.
Off-axis is the cone. And this cone intersects the Earth's surface in an ellipse. And you can be, you know, anywhere in this ellipse to see the same energy.
Can your 50 kiloton be separated into different locations,
yes,
the same
price? This is another example. We're very nice to have some feeling. Is it better to build one big chunk or build two or three? And I think this is quite an optimization which needs to be done. And it's not, now is the time to do that. Because once we, you know, build a building and put stuff in, it'll be too late. But this is a good question, which I think having some, you know, more input will be very, very interesting. So there are places which actually are realistic. We can build a little here. There are facilities nearby.
Canada?
This is in Canada. This is, yeah. So there are two most attractive sites. They're quite obvious. One is the closer to Sudan by about 20 kilometers. There's an abandoned mine which has all the facilities, all utilities, and quite flexible. And there's a further site in Canada at almost 1,000 kilometers from Fermilab, and there are two places which are, I showed you pictures. Now, we, and there's a number of places in between. Questions, where to go, or do you go to more than one direction, location, would be very, very interesting to have some physics input from you. So what we think is that we will have a two-phase program. In the first one, we want to build something like 50 kiloton fiducial detector with some 40% detection efficiency. And perhaps one would run with neutrinos for 1.5 years. That will give you expected, with no oscillations, 6,000 new mu events and 5 years in the neutrinos. And then based on this, I'll go to bigger phase, build a proton driver, have more protons, and build a bigger detector, or perhaps a bigger and better detector. Now, here is the thing which I wanted to impress on you, that what we can do, we can measure probability. And so how well you can measure it depends how big it is. If it's bigger, better, it's better. So this is the plot which shows as a function of the exposure in kiloton years, nominal years. What is the precision of probability if it's 3%, 1%, 0.5%, and it gets smaller. And this is a relative precision. So the answer is that if you are at 100 kiloton years and you have probability which is, let's say, 3%, you can measure it to about 12%. If it's 1%, you can measure it to 25%. If it gets smaller, well, it's 0.5%, you can get 40%.
Those are statistical.
Statistical. But so statistics dominates.
These statistics dominate.
Yes.
In the systematic.
This is very much smaller because number of events are so small. So right. Statistics starts to be important somewhere in around 500 kiloton years exposures. So we are sort of lucky that this thing here is all statistics. Now, in the phase two, when you go to this megaton, then you can measure things to about, let's say, we can measure 2% to 20%, and here one has to worry about systematics, but by that time we know the beam very well, we measure neutrino cross-sections, we know well. There are no showstoppers. At the moment, the main systematics come from unknown things like a production spectra, like a neutrino included cross-sections at low energies. But these things can be measured. So I think if we ever get to this thing here, we will make an extra effort to identify all these things, and we'll know that. So here's an example. Suppose that we are factor 5 below Shaw limit, and suppose that delta is 3 pi over 2. That's not a terribly pessimistic assumption. And if we measure neutrinos with 1.5 year duration, then this will actually subtend this area in this phase, in this plane of mixing angle and the delta function. Yeah, and the delta.
What angle is that? What is this curve?
So this is for 1.5 year of neutrino running. If, in fact, the theta 13 is 0.02, and delta is 3 pi over 2. Then we measure a number of events, which gives you probability. As you all know, this probability and nothing else, that allows you to be anywhere in this blue band.
What the band is, what's the critical angle?
Delta. There's a correlation between delta parameter and the missing angle.
That's delta going from
0 to pi.
I see. I mean 0 to pi. I see. But the,
okay. Now, if you measure things with infinite accuracy, then you have these two lines.
And so that says zero is still allowed.
Oh, yes.
For delta, for the CP.
Yeah.
You haven't yet found CP.
No, not at all.
Not at all. This is just one measurement.
One measurement. If you have 1.5 year neutrino and 5 years neutrinos, then if you combine them, you have still this. So you measure the angle to about factor of two.
Zero is a possibility.
Yes. With this phase one, you cannot measure CP.
Okay.
If this is 0.02, if I take it bigger, if you tell me what it is. Now, if, however, for the same parameters you go to phase two, then combining 1.5 year neutrinos with 5 years of antennas actually will give you, you know, quite a. Now, this is all exercise anyone can do, but we don't know what the phase is and what the mixing angle is.
What happens to that plot if the delta is much smaller? If you set a very optimal case there?
I can run this plot.
You can have it for the others.
What? You can make an infinite number of plots.
No, it must get much worse as you go down towards zero.
That's a good point. So, suppose we run for phase one at some distance like this near position, and we see something for neutrinos and for antineutrinos. Now, it very much depends what the result will be, what the next step should be, because there can be several possibilities. We can be seeing somewhere here or here. If we see it here or here, then we are in a very lucky position. We are in the best position, just run longer and you measure things better. If we measure something which is symmetric for neutrinos and anti-neutrinos, and actually we have discovered probably CP violation because you can be either here or here, but you don't know, are you here or are you there? And if you go to lower angles, actually these things start to overlap. So if you happen to be somewhere here, then probably the next phase would be to go to a place which can differentiate this from that. Now here, matter effects mess you up. You want to get rid of them. So if you go to this other location and go to lower energy, then these ellipses, which are here, now become like this. And if you are here, you'll be measuring 2% and 1% for antennas. If you are here, you will have switched. If you are here or there, that means that you actually know mass hierarchy, but you have now ambiguity between delta equals zero or pi. And if you want to differentiate this from that, you have to go to a different distance or different energies where this ellipse actually gets bigger. These ellipses are sort of squashed to a line exactly at the minimum, and they get broader on both sides of the minimum. So if we have an indication that we are somewhere here, then we go to different energy to be able to differentiate one side on another. So there's no point right now. If you had all the money right now to do this, one wouldn't know where to go. You really need some first phase to guide you to make this big investment later on to be as productive as possible. And for this, actually, maybe it's a good idea to have a detector which is movable. And that's not at all crazy, because you have to build a huge detector. Now, I can put numbers 20 kiloton, 50 kiloton. It's very easy. I can even draw a little drawing showing you what it looks like. Again, it's very easy. But this thing, it will be like 20 meter tall, 20 meter high, and have walls which are that thick. Now imagine building a wall which is 20 meters tall, which is 6 stories tall, and 300 of them. Boy, it is a non-trivial, it's possible, but it's non-trivial. it turns out that probably the easiest way to do it is to actually use the fact that industry has developed ways of doing these things. It's called shipping containers. Now, they stack 9 high. So if you can build a detector inside a shipping container and then stack them, then the problem is solved. This thing here contains like 10, 20 kiloton experiments. And it's being done every day. So this is not at all crazy to think that we can build a detector inside these containers, put them somewhere, and they'll be quite as easy to move them from one place to another or ship them to Japan or wherever else. So this is something which we are pursuing very, very seriously, because this gives us flexibility to react to physics results of the phase one. Well, here is an example how JHF and NUMMI are complementary, because these are ellipses for different angles, 7.05, 003, and you want to know if you are here or here. This tells you mass hierarchy. But if you go to smaller angles, if you are somewhere here, then you don't know. You can be either here or there. But at the same time, if you have measurement at JHF, then if we are here because we are on the red point, JHF will be here. If you are here because we are on this, JHF will be here. And actually, this was a thing which I have done some time ago, and by now, Nunokawa and Minakata and Park have pointed out that comparing neutrino measurements with JHF and with NUMMI is much, much more sensitive. Because here, in this kind of a comparison, unknown CP phase is a big factor, because it can change your probability from here to there. If you compare neutrino at JHF and neutrino at NUMMI, then whatever CP phase is, it is probably the same in Japan as in the US. And the only difference between them is matter effects. So comparison of the NUMMI with JHF tells you a sign of a matter effect. And it's not a,
what's the big difference between NUMMI and JHF?
JHF is much closer, so there are no matter effects.
Well, JHF is closer. Yeah.
It's closer and lower energy. There's no matter effects. Right. And that's nice, because this gives you a complementary view. This thing is quite complicated, and we are just at the beginning of the whole thing. So having a measurement of the same things under different conditions gives you extra handles to disentangle various physics cases. Well, we want to measure a number of new events. It's proportional to the mass and number of protons. And at some point, it becomes cheaper to invest into building more protons rather than building more mass. So one has to think about how to split the money, if you have it. If you don't have it, then it's not a very big deal. To maximize the product rather than to maximize any single component. And we started this project already, and there are a number of things which one can do to the physics, to the main injector and main booster complex. And with something like $45 million, one could actually double, one could reach the design and even double this by year 2008. So we think it's probably a very worthwhile project to propose at the same time to build the detector and to invest in the machine to double this. This will make even bigger reach compared to what they have shown you. There is a letter of intent submitted to Fermilab, and has quite a positive reaction from PEC, saying, well, good idea, come with a proposal. So, GI mobile time. So I think it's quite interesting that the single reaction of new mu to new oscillations, new appearance, provides a very, very powerful tool to determine parameters of another importance for neutrino sector. It is very lucky for us that neutrino beam as built, now it's not yet finished, it takes 10 years to build a beam, offers a unique laboratory for an optimal experiment, because it has this matter effect which can be used to learn more physics, and provides you flexibility to optimize all over E. And off-axis detectors, one or more, in combination with the upgrades of Fermilab in the machines, we improve our sensitivity by something like 2 orders of magnitude beyond show limit. And well, it could very well be that if some of these scenarios of Antonelli actually are right, that we can determine mass hierarchy and perhaps even get a first hint of CP variation in the sector, maybe within our reach. And the beam will start in a year and a half, and large detectors can be built in maybe in 3, 4, 5 years, is probably minimum one can get anything done nowadays. So I think we should just go and do it. Thank you. Yes?
What's the scenario, if it turns out that science for 2 theta 1 3 is, you know, very small, 0.001, I mean, you start pushing.
What do you do? Well, I think the fact that new E component of a beam is 0.5% gives you some kind of a yardstick, because it's not a limitation because you know it, so you can subtract it. But fluctuation of this is your error. Later on, the systematic error becomes a problem. So I think you can probably go down to 0.001. And on sin squared 2 theta 1 3, that's probably the limit below which this technique does not give you any chance. You have no chance to go beyond that.
So you never go to phase two,
and you still go? Phase one gives you 0.01.
So you're saying in phase two you can go to
002. Double O2. Right. If it's a factor 10 beyond phase one. If it's below then it's only neutrino factors that can give you. On the other hand, if you know it's few percent, as some of the theorists tell you, then it's very well within our reach. So I think it's probably prudent to go step by step and see where we are. But if people have wisdom of how one should really do these things, that would be very, very helpful. Because we are totally blind. And we don't know. 10 years ago, nobody believed this in the first place. The fact this thing is there is quite a remarkable success in the first place. And now suppose Miniboom finds an effect. The whole thing will change very much. So I think making too long of a plans it's proving to be not terribly useful. You just have to see what you can do, and your results guide you for the next phase. Right.
Take some question. Can you put some strong limit in the stellar component?
I'm sorry?
In the stellar component? In the new Sapiens channel? Or the microphone is too small?
Let me answer a different question which you didn't ask. If you measure this shape of disappearance, you can tell oscillations from other mechanisms like decays or something. You can do that. I think if you try to see stellar component by seeing that there are two components of the oscillations with different waveforms, that would be very hard. But I don't know. This is a very sensible thing to try, and probably having enough statistics one can perhaps get some limit, but not anytime soon, because this would require you to understand your beam spectrum very well. If you want to see a big dip somewhere, that's easy. If you want to see that your shape is not exactly sine square, it's much, much more delicate measurement, requires a lot more effort. But I suppose...
If you're measuring the angle, you use some limit on the sterile between us?
Maybe what?
Theta 2, 3. No, it's a matter of fact. 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 It's a mat that to understand your systematics, I think, would be very, very hard. It's, you can probably try to prove that there are no steroid but active neutrinos, but to get a limit on them, I would be very. I should look into more details, but my gut feeling is that it would be very difficult.
So if you want to push the complementarity of JHF and UMI, then it seems like that you want to choose the longer baseline.
I would very much agree with you, but one has to.
Because otherwise you don't get enough. You get more matter effects.
Right. There's very delicate area to do that, and having more physics-driven argument, I think, is probably having scenarios of what one can do for different scenarios would be very useful to settle this. I would very strongly agree with you that we should not be too narrow-minded, but should see what we can learn, and ignoring things that are happening out there is silly.
Is there any possibility or interest in looking for tau appearance?
Well, first of all, it's done. It's being done at Gansaso. Second, this thing has actually quite orthogonal needs because you want to be above tau threshold when you see taus. If you have a tau threshold, then taus give you a huge background to new E's. So do this or that, but you cannot do both. We have actually thought about having a MR-SNP detector as well in Sudan, but after Gansaso went through, again, it's competing or making same measurements is not worthwhile. It's probably better to have to learn more physics. It's possible, because, for example, when we built a cavern for Minos, there is a space in front of Minos, like 10, 15 meters. So if sometime in the future we actually decide that there is some fantastic physics to be had. So this space, beam is capable, we can do that. So it's not excluded. It is not on top of our list of priorities right now, but it is not excluded.
See, normally people argue that you have to go much, much larger distances to do the CP violation. But if I can understand the argument here is, if you're lucky, you might be able to do it at a shorter distance.
Well,
is that the way of thinking this? If things are large enough, and because usually the argument has been made, certainly a snow mass is made, then you really need to go a couple thousand kilometers.
With what kind of energy?
With the neutrino factor means, whatever
you have. Is it rather low energy?
Yeah, 1,000. I mean, that, I'm saying the lower has been.
Yes.
This, for example, is there is a Brookhaven proposal that you know about, which is to go a couple thousand kilometers or something like that. So you're now arguing that under certain conditions, if I understand what you're saying here, if you're very lucky, use neutrinos and antineutrinos, sine square 2 theta 1 3 is large enough, CP violation is large enough, you can really do it at this distance.
Now, it's very lucky that different people have different views and different tastes. Now, it's fun to run programs and calculate at which distance, what energy you get maximum effect. But I tend to be practical. It took us 10 years, and we still not yet with building this beam. So building a beam for fields, it's very, very far.
So you're arguing you should explore this because it's already been.
This is a huge investment which you are making in this. And I think first thing is to see if it is good for you or not. Trying to propose right now a billion dollar things before you actually have finished this, I don't think it's realistic. So it is a fun thing to do, and I'm doing this as well, but I think to be practical, we've got to make best use of what we have.
So you explore this region and look at the region.
Yes. Besides, learning this can help you to optimize your next step.
You're going to build in phase one a 50 kiloton detector. Is there any advantage to building 225 kilotons and putting them at 700 and 900?
That's a question which is a very good one. It can be done. So I think it's very important that people try to think about various pros and cons. And I have got feeling that having two measurements can be actually better than having one which is twice as good. So I would very, very strongly agree with that. Now, to
doesn't that have a little
I mean, I know what's the minimum size to make efficient use of the carbon detector?
Well, 15 to 20 kilotons is already very big. Now, one other thing which I wanted to point out is, along these lines, it is probably very important not to get stuck in one place by building a fantastically beautiful cavern or building. You can topple easily a lot of money in the building. Now, these things here actually allow you much greater flexibility because you can use these things and you can, to first order, put a tent around it and then you have it. It's not that simple. But you can use, once you stuck this thing here, this is a very, very solid element. You don't need a building to support itself. You can use this to support the roof, for example. So we are very actively investigating how you would build a decent building around the detector built this way. This can be a lot cheaper.
And then are you proposing to build the detector on the barge or just move the detector on the barge?
Well, we actually thought about putting on a barge and move along Lake Superior.
Yeah, okay.
That's a possible thing. If you build these things in containers, actually moving this thing from one place to another, even by truck, is not a big deal. To give you a scale, 20 kiloton detector is about 1,000 containers. It's peanut compared to what is being done every day. So I think it's a very attractive idea to move this thing, to build a detector which is intrinsically, it's not trivial to move, but it's not all that hard.
Well, this is exactly the idea of Icarus. We build it in Pavia and we transport it to the Gran Sasso. And that even looks like a picture. Right. Maybe you had a picture of moving Icarus because it looks like
it could be. I don't know. Yeah.
So would the Minos detector continue to run once you constructed the off-axis detector?
Yes, because the things are running at the same time.
The detector's fine.
Yeah, that's fine. And it's built to measure new disappearance, and that's fine. And I think having this thing here, in addition to new disappearance, gives you more constraints. You are constraining more the whole picture of oscillations.
There's another problem I've heard actually from Bob Cousins, that the proton economy, the Fermilab, is going to be somewhat constrained in 2005, 2006 because of let's say, if CKM runs, all these other things we hear about, and then, of course, the Tevatron. Does this take into account the sharing of the beam with the Tevatron and the CKM and all that?
It does take care of the Tevatron. There's no CKM folded in.
At this time?
At this time, yeah. So, yes, but it'll be even more important to push for this improvement to the machine. Yes. Well, it is almost a beam, but because there's another thing which I didn't mention, that there are plans to replace our booster by a new proton driver, which can give you some factor 5 beyond where we are. And I think this program is so important, so new, and so uniquely well matched to the Fermilab infrastructure, we should go for it. So we hope that this phase 2 will actually include not this, but include building an extra proton driver, which can be, you know, $150 million. It's not trivial, not cheap, but I think physics is so important that we should do it.
Is the timetable such that you can locate the new detector at the Nodal Insper from the Minos run? So you're sure you're working on oscillation
peak? You can do that if you like. I don't think
2007 allows that, you said, because in 2005 or so you get a measurement.
No. When is Minos going to get a good
measure? Well, 06.
What?
In 06 we should know Delta M square very well.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. I would think so.
Going to start data taking in 2005.
Yes. In January 05. And I think that in 6 months, you know Delta M square to, I don't know, 25-30%. But the thing is, being so big, just look where the minimum is and no blind view.
If it's low, that may not be true, right?
If it's very low, then.
Well, you know, it's low.
Yeah. But in the normal region.
Now, one thing which I wanted to actually address your question is, is it sensible to choose a site before you have narrowed down delta M squared? And I think answer is you don't want to wait. You don't want to wait because of a couple of things. One is that oscillation maximum is very, very wide. So suppose, here's the maximum. Suppose you have 2GB beam, or suppose you have 3GB beam, which is factor 1.5 difference. A difference in your power isn't all that great, because the fraction of events which oscillated is now not 10%, not 90%, but only 80%. So you have not ideal experiment, but it's pretty good. Over this thing here, you don't have to know it very, very precisely. That's one thing. Second, if you start moving things to optimal energy, your flux drops. You can choose your energy by choosing an angle, but your flux is dropping at the same time. So you probably want to be a very narrow window over which you really can optimize your energy. Distance is something else, but this is given by physics. You don't have to know. Well, knowing better your solar delta M square may help you a little bit, but not very much.
Well, it helps you eliminate the ambiguities that you can set on the
gate. Well, if you have ambiguities, we are in fat city. I think we're very, very, very far from.
But you should think ahead to be able to resolve them if you can. Right?
Yes.
The first thing they have to do is see if you can find something.
Right.
Everything else is secondary.
Not necessarily.
I mean, if you don't find anything, you're done.
But if you find it, you don't have to redesign.
Well, then you can worry. If you find it, you're in great shape.
Yeah. The argument here is a little bit different.
Yeah, but you wouldn't find CP violation.
Not CP violation.
No, finding new E's in the first place would be a big success.
So this is a plan to find the reason that this is science with
them. I understand. Yeah. The first thing is to find them. Yeah. And make sure you find them. Yeah. Yeah. Else
That's why delaying things is not very, very rational, because there'll be enough delays put by things above. So
the argument is making, I could just do it. You cannot just find them and then wait another 10 years and do something. No. You need to have kind of a continuous plan. You find something, and then there's even the chance you'll see CP violation. So, and then phase one, phase two. I think this makes a lot of sense.
Right. But then if there is very sharp maximum of your possibilities, then we have to know this. From all what you looked at, yes, you be better here and there, but even it's very small. So very, very shallow minimum. Therefore,
you just. No problems. If you don't find something in phase one, you probably will never go to phase two. So that's really what.
That's a good question.
If you don't.
You find something, you've got a good argument.
Then you go to phase two. And then probably if you don't find something,
it may be true. But if you follow this line, that means that you should go for as big as you can really afford it in phase one. Because otherwise you can cut yourself from the phase two. So that's why we went from this 20 kilotons to 50, exactly following this kind of logic. That is probably very good poetically to have something.
As you know very well, 50 kilotons of liquid argon is also possible.
Yeah?
So how does this timetable compare with JHF in terms of getting the new needs?
Well, if you can tell me how quickly you can get approval and money.
It's supposed to take your schedule.
I think we probably can be ahead a little bit if you're really very efficient. It will be a remarkable success. A terminal building takes 5 times longer than should, so if you extrapolate this. With JHF has very much the same problem which we are discussing, that the JHF beam is very ambitious, very expensive to build. And it's a lot more expensive because they are thinking ahead. If they want to only build phase one, it would be a much easier thing to build. But they want to be in position to explore things further. So they want to go to this 4 megawatt beam. And this implodes. Our stupid pipe, which we bury, is now covered with 2.5 meters of concrete on both sides. JHF has 7 meters of concrete. It's just phenomenal. But it costs a lot of money. So I think it is very difficult beam to build. There's a number of difficulties, both financially and technically. And we should go as fast as we can. So let's go as fast as they can. And it's to our own, you know, to common interest that we think it done as soon as possible. Trying to beat JHF by 6 months, a year, I don't think it makes sense. This is a long-term program. New experiments don't get done in a few months.
I'm curious, you follow these things, I should know, but I don't. There's also off-axis beams in Europe. People were looking at some various places, which also come for free. It's exactly the same situation. Do you know anything about what's... I haven't followed... I'm only following the on-axis beams.
Well...
Yeah, but he still was using off-axis in the
Ukrainian. Kinematics is the same in the States and Europe, so the thing is there.
No change between the two.
Well, slowly.
So it's a little bit higher energy.
Not a lot, but it's much higher. So if you go to 20 JeV pions, 20 JeV, okay, then your flux drops like a rock. So if you want, if you run beam to Gansasso and run Opera and Icarus, if you go off-axis, you have the same energies, but you have no flux. So if you really want to do anything, you have to build a low-energy version of a beam.
So you say right now the off-axis beam, even though DDAC says otherwise, DDAC wants to build a very big detector.
Well, what DDAC wants to do...
He also wants a low-energy beam.
He wants to reduce the beam.
He wants to reduce the beam and basically kill Icarus.
Well,
you cannot kill Icarus, you don't. So you just have the strength.
That is the underlying current that people say. But if you start running in high energy beam, you irradiate the whole thing. And to work there, it's just impossible.
So you're saying, I think this is probably true, that the off axis beams in Europe are not very useful?
No.
They don't have the flexibility of energy.
No. No, they were not. We are lucky that we just thought about it at the right time before we casting and drawing.
I'm saying it's not entirely true. There is a way to redesign the horns a little, to go a little more energy, but not to this kind of energy.
In order to make low energy beam, you have to take a target and put it into the horn. Now, everything is very relative. You want to build things which are as robust as possible. But so, for example,
the third beam has not been run yet.
No,
there's still 2 years that you could actually change it.
Let me tell you.
Yeah.
CERN target is designed in such a way that you can replace targets when they break. It's done by building a big can and rotate targets. Yeah. This can cannot fit into the horn. No way. So, given a current target design, you can't possibly move things in.
You really cannot go that much lower energy. You have to go a little lower.
Little bit, but
what
no.
The off-axis beams are really confined to JHF and NUMI.
You have to design this beam.
Which I think is fine.
That's a different.
Yeah. But of course, NUMI is built in Brookhaven, isn't it? So.
Carl?
When were the super beam the furry lot into this
program? Well, I don't have any better knowledge than you do. I think it's quite conceivable that we can start constructing this thing here, I don't know, 3 years from now, and do it maybe now, 07, 08. We're going to run for 5 years. We have now this review of these future things, and from what I hear, we are putting proton upgrades to be buildable by 2010. That's what we were saying. Yes. So it is possible.
Before people go,
by 2010.
We need to plan for dinner. So
yeah.
Maybe we better take our questions with you later, privately.
Okay.
Thank you again.